Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
I'm Kathy with a K.
And I'm Kathy with a C.
And this is Killer Destinations. Today's destination is DeWitt, New York. DeWitt is a small town in New York just outside of Syracuse. And in 2003, shocking news made headlines around the world when it was discovered that a vicious sexual predator had created a chamber of terror.
It had been 6 months since Angela saw her 16-year-old sister, whom we will refer to as Jane. Jane had a 2-year-old child, and she had run away before, but never for this long, and never without checking on her child. On April 8, 2003, Angela received a phone call that she didn't expect. It was her sister Jane calling on Angela's home phone. Jane was speaking in hushed tones, and Angela quickly realized that her sister was not okay. When Angela asked what was going on, Jane whispered, "He's a rapist." Jane told Angela that she knew she was in the town of Manlius, but didn't know exactly where she was. So Angela knew that Jane was being held against her will. So what Angela did was she gave Jane her cell number, and Jane memorized it. And then Jane hung up very abruptly. Here's what happened 6 months prior. So we're going to backtrack. In October of 2002, 16-year-old Jane was walking through Syracuse. She was near the intersection of Elk and Salina. She was offered a ride, Kath, and she accepted. The driver was in his 60s. He was an older man with gray hair, balding on top, and he had glasses. He looked classically harmless. Little did Jane know that this misplaced trust would begin a horrific nightmare. Jane was taken to his house, locked in a room, stripped of her clothes, threatened that dogs would attack her and kill her if she attempted to leave, and she was chained to the floor. Within a few weeks, Jane was allowed out of her dungeon and able to go upstairs, but she was still captive. She wasn't free and she had no freedom. He would allow her to go upstairs where his bedroom was, where the bathroom was, where the living room was. However, all the doors had locks and all the windows were covered. She couldn't see out and nobody could see in.
I read somewhere, though, that there were bars or a grate of some sort, but they were on the inside of the windows, not the outside.
Exactly. But after nearly 6 months of captivity, her captor took her to Freddy's Bar and Grill, and it happened to be karaoke night. And Jane wanted to sing. You know, she wanted to involve herself in the karaoke. He originally said no. Her captor said, "No, you can't do that." And she's like, "Come on, come on, let me. And he did. He let her up on the stage to sing. However, he went up with her and stood next to her.
That's not awkward.
Correct. And so the patrons...
I mean, I do it when you're up there, but that's just because I can't sing.
Right. Actually, about 5 years ago, a bunch of us went to Catalina for our birthdays. And of course, toward the end of the evening, we go to a karaoke bar and all my friends are like, "Let's go, you know, do karaoke, blah, blah, blah." They all got up on stage. I was like, "I'll be the official photographer."
But you sing on the podcast.
I sing like a fool, like not, you know, ha, ha, ha. It's just you and me.
What, karaoke?
I don't feel like everybody else is staring at me.
They're not.
I know.
Well, but, now they are.
But but yeah, I'm not going to get up on a stage.
With those 50 people in the room.
Exactly. Okay. 50 strangers. I will pretend to care about your karaoke and I will take the pictures.
There you go.
And my friends were fools. They looked terrible.
Absolutely.
And it was hysterical. So anyway, so her captor takes Jane to Freddy's Bar and Grill. He allows her to get up on stage. And again, he's standing next to her on stage, just standing there, not singing. And the entire place thinks it's odd because he's an older man. She is a younger woman.
She wasn't a younger woman. She was a teenager.
Yeah, she was a kid.
Yeah.
She was 16. People in the bar also noticed that as she was going to the bathroom, he was escorting her to the bathroom. But nobody called the police. Nobody said anything.
Well, but you know, you and I had talked about this, Kath, and you had made the comment, which is so true. All of us like to think that if we were in that situation and we saw someone doing that, where we're like, oh, this might be a little odd, that we'd be like, oh, we'll call the police and just tell them that they need to do a welfare check or something like that. When the reality is, you don't.
90% of us wouldn't do it. I mean, there's some, absolutely. We all envision ourselves to be the heroes, but in reality,
we're most the only of heroes.
Most of us wouldn't be.
Right.
So just a few days later, after going to Freddy's Bar and Grill and Jane not trying to escape, and as far as we know, not sending any messages to anybody, and honestly, I don't think she had a moment to herself, but her captor was sort of, oh, okay, I can take her out. This is going to be okay. So according to an article in the Post Standard by Mike McAndrew and Mike Fish, Jane's captor took her to a bottle return center called FM Returnables in the village of Manlius. And this is just 9 miles outside of Syracuse. And her captor, it turns out, was a penny pincher of epic proportions. And his way of getting pocket change was to collect bottles and return them, you know, recycle. But he was also a bottle collector. So he would go to this place and he would look at the recyclings that people turned in and see if there were any unique beer bottles. And then he would take them home. So while they're at the bottle return center, her captor went to the woman working behind the counter, and her name was Terry. And they knew each other because they had seen each other around.
He'd been in there time to time.
Yeah. Exactly. So he asked to use the phone. He said, can we please use the phone? We need to call and find out what church service times are. So as I understand it, Jane told him she wanted this information.
Because he trusted her enough now to take her to church?
Apparently. This is my guess because, you know, putting the pieces of the puzzle together from all the newspaper articles I read. So what happened is he is standing next to Jane as they are looking through a phone book, I believe, for the number of this church. And so, you know,
it was Yellow Pages, right?
I believe it was. Okay.
And if you don't know what that is.
Yeah. Ask your parents. So the three of them are standing there, Terry, Jane, and this man, okay? Jane picks up the phone as though she is calling the church number, but that's when she dials her sister's home number. And that's when her sister answers the phone. They have a very cryptic phone conversation while Jane is pretending to speak with a church person. And then she whispers, he's a rapist. And this all happened, by the way, as the captor was counting his coins.
That he'd made from recycling the bottles.
Exactly. So he's distracted momentarily and she gets in a few, you know, important words to her sister. Her sister says, this is my cell number. Here's my cell number. And so Jane memorized the cell number. The sister's fiance says, let's get in the car. They get the number that had called them off the caller ID. They get to their phones and they use their cell number to call back. So they get in touch with Terry and they say, hey, the girl that was just in there is my sister and she's a kidnap victim. She is being held against her will. Are they still there? I'm calling the police. You know, all this frantic conversation. Well, Terry believes everything Angela is saying. And so Terry says, I know where they're going next. They're going to a store called Pets Are People Too. It was a relatively new store and it was being opened by a guy named Keith, who happened to be Terry's manager at the bottle return store.
And I'm guessing Manlius is a small town.
That is my impression.
Yeah. But thank goodness.
Exactly. So she calls Keith at, you know, Pets Are People Too. And she says, there's an older man with a teenage girl. She's a kidnap victim. You know, he too immediately believed Terry. And he says, they're here. And he writes down the license plate. Now, Angela lived only like 9 to 10 miles from this bottle return facility. So Angela and her fiance are on their way to the bottle return facility to meet Terry. Keith at the pet store has written down this guy's license plate number. Because Angela and Terry both called police, police meet at the bottle redemption center. So there's a female police officer there. There's Terry, there's Angela, and there's Angela's fiance. And the four are furiously discussing what happens. In that moment, Angela's cell phone rings and it's Jane. So she's back on the phone and she has no idea where she is, but she's giving a description. She says, I see a yellow car and a Dodge sign. So the police officer immediately knew which Dodge dealership they were at. And so Keith, who had called in the license plate, the cops are running the license plate. They know where he lives. They send a patrol car to his house. And then they get the call from the police officer at the bottle return facility. And they all descend on this Dodge dealership or this Dodge Center. I'm not even sure it was a dealership. I believe it was. Anyway, it was called Fayetteville Dodge. They waited until Jane and her captor got back in their car, and then they were immediately surrounded. So what had happened is Jane had gone into Fayetteville Dodge with the captor and again asked to borrow a phone. I do not know how she got away with it. I do not know the story because none of that was reported in any newspaper that I read. And
you
I read a
details.
Million. Exactly. But what I assume happened is that, again, she called her sister and she pretended to be speaking with a church or something else and mentioned what she saw, the Dodge sign, the yellow car. Anyway, the crazy thing is that the police pull him out of the car, pull both of them out of the car. There's a female police officer who immediately takes Jane, gives her a big hug, and pulls her away. The captor is identified by his license as 68-year-old John Jamelski. And he was as cool as a cucumber, and he acted like nothing was wrong. He's like, "That's my girlfriend. This is a misunderstanding. That's my girlfriend. And I shouldn't be telling you this, but I picked her up and we have this agreement that, you know, she would make some money and she would come live with me for a month. She's my girlfriend."
So acting like she's a streetwalker almost, but saying like,
"But she's my girlfriend."
Because she's agreed to stay with him for a long time.
Right. Like yeah. he was like, "This is no big deal. This is no big deal." Part of the difficulty was that because Jane had run away from home in the past, she was never reported missing. So police are like, "Huh, well, get in the back of our car." And on the way to the station, he was chit-chatting, making conversation, not acting.
No concern at all.
No concern at all. So John Jamelski was arrested that day. And then Jane told detectives a story that they had a very hard time believing. She said she was kept in a filthy basement with graffiti on the walls. There were no windows. She was deprived of food frequently. She had very little to drink. She slept on a foam mattress.
On top of plywood.
Correct. And there was no plumbing. So she, when she needed to use the bathroom, it was like a hospital style toilet, like a toilet chair. And
with a bucket underneath it.
Yes. And Jamelski watched. And she was raped daily, sometimes multiple times. And she was required to keep a diary. And she was not allowed to bathe as often as she wanted. And she was...
And even when she bathed, he watched her do that too.
Correct. There was a dingy secondhand tub that was fed by a hose. Like the place was disgusting and it was super moist. It was humid and...
It was like Amstetten in the Fritzels.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But she was forced to make sex videos and the police were in complete and total shock.
So a search warrant was issued for Jamelski's home in DeWitt, and the stuff they found there, Kathy, actually kind of fits with what you would think a 68-year-old man who's trolling for 16-year-olds might have. It was like a hoarder lived there. Food cartons and newspapers and boxes and all that kind of stuff. Kathy just said the right word. He was just gross. And then as part of this big mess, Kathy, thousands of photographs were inside of this home. So they confiscated all of those, old magazines, old receipts, everything you can imagine a hoarder house would have. Although I didn't hear about there being dead pets. So I know that's something that's usually on hoarders.
I don't think any dead pets.
Kathy had also made the comment that he liked to recycle beer bottles, but also would look for any interesting ones that might be something he'd want to take home. He had more than 13,000 beer bottles in this hoarder home, which can't even imagine that. Yeah. Jane had told them where she was kept in the basement. And basically, this was something that you had to walk down into the basement, and then he basically just dug a passageway and then a hole that he then lined with concrete.
Oh, here's the crazy thing about that.
Yes.
Terry, the woman behind the counter at the bottle recycling center, happened to be married to a man who laid the concrete.
Wow.
In the mid-80s.
And at the time, probably said it was for a bomb shelter.
That's exactly right.
Isn't that when Josef Fritzl also did the thing in Amstetten? But I mean,
that makes sense. Like the Cold War was the Cold War was at its peak.
Have you not seen The Sound of Music?
You know,
they were fine.
What about that song by Sting? Mr. Khrushchev said we will bury you.
Yeah. And look how wrong he was.
I don't subscribe to this point of view. Yes, it was called I Hope the Russians Love Their Children Too.
Yes.
And that was like the 1980s was a Cold War time. Anyway, so yes, he said it was like a bomb shelter or something like that.
So in order to find the dungeon where Jane had been kept, they took 9 steps down into the basement and they found a 4-foot by 4-foot steel door that was against the backside of the wall. When they opened that up, it didn't get any taller than 4 feet, so they were required to kind of crawl their way through until they came across another door, this one being smaller. So this one was 3-foot by 3-foot, and as you went through that, it brought you to a place where the space around you got bigger, and so you had to kind of scoot your way out of the 3-foot by 3-foot area and drop yourself down into a larger bomb shelter type area. And as Kathy had said, it was filthy and it was smelly and it was damp. And inside of it was the bathroom. Kathy talked about this hospital chair with a bucket as a toilet and the foam mattress and all that kind of stuff.
There were 2 rooms as part of this dungeon.
Right. Well, and one of them was the bedroom. They also discovered that air was being pumped into this area through a hose. But then the other interesting thing about these 2 different passageways, the 4-foot passageway and the 3-foot passageway, is that the doors were locked with a combination lock, not a key, not something that somebody else could get a hold of. So if anything happened to him down in that basement, if Jane had tried anything, she never would have been able to get out of there.
Right. But he would lock the combo
behind him
as he dropped down into the basement.
Right.
And make a production of it so that she saw.
As the detectives went down there to take a look, and they were looking around at the walls and all the other gross things that were down there, they did see that there was graffiti on the wall. And it said, Wall of Thugs. And painted next to this was a peace sign. The detective who saw this, his blood ran cold. Because he immediately knew that Jane was not the only victim. 2 years prior to Jane uncovering for the police this den of terror, a 26-year-old young woman named Jennifer had walked into the police station with an unbelievable account of something that had happened to her. She told police that she had been held captive in an underground bunker for 2 months somewhere nearby. She couldn't remember exactly where it was, and the reason she couldn't be more specific is that Jennifer had just completed her shift at Outback Steakhouse and was walking to her friend's house along Geddes Street. And according to an account that we heard later, she was heavily intoxicated. But it was raining, and so an older man in a tan-colored Mercury Comet, which I had to look that up, offered her a ride, and she accepted. But once she was in the car, she kind of started getting her spidey senses going, and so she tried to get out of the car, but she couldn't. The next thing Jennifer knew after trying to get out of the car and not being able to is that she awoke in a dark concrete room, completely naked and alone. A few days later, her family reported her missing to the police, but what they didn't know is that at that point when they did this, she was chained to the floor of this cell and her captor had threatened to sell her over the internet for $30,000. But like Jane, she was raped every day. She was only allowed to bathe every 2 weeks or so, definitely not as often as she wanted to. Jennifer actually also said she was never allowed to brush her teeth.
Oh.
I know.
That's super random.
Super gross.
Yeah.
It was reported that the first time that John Jamelski tried to rape her, she fought with everything she had. And for her efforts, she got a burning cigar stuck on her back. And she said that taught her not to fight again. Jennifer was also forced to write letters to her family saying that she was in a rehabilitation facility, so don't worry about her. She was taking care of herself. And she did have a drug problem. She was known for that and had been to rehab several times. So it was something that her family probably didn't give a second thought to.
They were probably pleased. Right, oh my God, thank God. She checked herself in. She's getting help, you know?
But then suddenly after 2 months, Jamelski released her. And she said that he blindfolded her and handcuffed her and drove her around in his car for about 30 minutes. And she was sure that he was going to take her someplace and kill her. When he stopped the car, and remember, she's blindfolded, she took her blindfold off and he had dropped her at her mother's house. How he knew that, I don't know, but I'm sure that freaked her out.
Oh, yeah.
But as she got out of the car, he threatened to kill her and her family if she told police. But of course, she did go to police and told them what happened, but they were skeptical of her story for a number of reasons. And basically, it was because she did have a history with drug problems, and she had written all these letters to her parents saying she was in drug rehab. Now, police tried to find out if maybe she was telling the truth, but they said they couldn't confirm if she'd been in rehab because whenever they called a facility, they refused to confirm or deny if she had ever been there. The other challenge they had is that when Jennifer got out of the car, she had said she thought she was dead and was so grateful when she got out of the car that when she closed the door, she said, "Thank you, thank you." She was thanking God for getting her there safely, but she had a neighbor overhear her and told the police, well, when the guy dropped her off, she thanked him for dropping her off. So the police, of course, were like, yeah, this is sketch. Yeah. We're not really sure.
And one of the things that, Kath, I thought was, I read this in a couple places, and I have no idea if the witness saw this, but he supposedly gave her $270. Mm-hmm. Like, here's $270. I mean,
random.
Totally random.
But it also, like you said, it takes away that, huh?
Yeah.
Did it really happen? Because why would he give you cash if...
And
is this payment for services rendered?
What a chess player he was.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm going to give her money. She's going to take it. And then it's going to screw her in the long run. No one's going to believe her.
Right. But what happened, though, is that one of the last things she told police is that where she'd been held, there was graffiti on the walls. And there was a sign that said Wall of Thugs near a giant peace sign. She also told police that her captor, who we know as Jamelski, drove a 1975 tan Mercury Comet, the exact same car that Jamelski drove. Again, Syracuse police are still trying to see, like, you know, let's see if we can believe her. Let's see what it is. And so she had said it was a 1975 or 74. I read it in several places differently. But let's say she said it was a 75 and the police searched for a tan 75 Mercury Comet registered to anybody and they didn't find it. But she was off by a year and they never checked any other year of the car.
Which is incredible to me because a Comet is so unique. Like it was considered a vintage vehicle at the time. And so you'd think they'd be like, oh, a tan Comet. Maybe we should check within 5 years. In my heart of hearts, I believe that was indicative of the fact that they truly didn't buy into her story. Having a history with usage and, you know, having the letters about the rehab and having the neighbor saying, she said, thank you. They're like, eh. But they did drive her around the city trying to look for anything that she could identify. But of course, she was blindfolded.
Right.
And she was not one who was led up into the upper parts of the house because she was a fighter.
Now, when the search warrant was issued, the police were like, oh, crap.
Yeah, they see the big Wall of Thugs written there.
And they realized she was telling the truth and had been held in the same place as Jane. So the Onondaga County Sheriff's Office and the Syracuse Police Department worked together on this investigation, and both agencies now suspected there were more victims. What's the likelihood that he only kidnapped and assaulted two women, considering the amount of time that this spanned? And so the Sheriff of Onondaga County issued a public appeal for any other victims to come forward.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
Yeah, so Kath, the police were very aware that Jennifer was kidnapped in May of 2001. So she was released approximately July of 2001. Jane was not kidnapped until October of 2002, and then she escaped in April of 2003. So there was a lot of time in between those kidnappings. And with all of the photos and all of the videos they confiscated during the search warrant, they could not possibly believe he only had two victims.
And so after making this public appeal, ultimately, three additional women came forward.
So we're going to back up to the first victim that police became aware of. This was a 14-year-old girl named Kirsten, who in September of 1988 was walking along South Geta Street in Syracuse.
This is the street the victim number four, Jennifer, had been kidnapped from in 2001.
Kirsten was interviewed on The Oprah Show years later, and we know that Jamelski persuaded her to get into his car. However, she doesn't remember the details. She was out drinking with friends. Jamelski pulled up, and the next thing she remembers is waking up with no clothes on. But what her friends told her later was that, you know, they were drinking, they were walking down the sidewalk. He pulls up and she just gets into his car.
Like he was able to persuade her to do it. She didn't really bat an eyelash.
Right. Something like that. It was an easy peasy situation. Kirsten was kept not in his dungeon because it wasn't built at the time, but for the first 11 months of her captivity, she was kept in a well on his mother's property. That is unbelievable to me. 14 years old.
Yeah.
And she was forced to write letters home to her family to say that she was doing fine, she was okay, you know, all this kind of nonsense. But once the bunker is up and running, so to speak, he transfers Kirsten to the bunker. He chains her by her ankle to a hook in the basement, and he told her that he had powerful bosses and that these bosses sold girls into sex slavery. And that maybe he was going to be required to sell her. So she too was a victim of daily rapes, sometimes multiple times a day, and she had to make sex videos. She also pretended to go along with some of the things. For example, I saw a video, it was so sad. She was dancing in the video, pretending to have a good time, and then, you know, she gets a little bit more serious, and you could tell she really believed that he had these powerful bosses. So she's dancing and she's like, okay, so maybe now it's time that I can go home. I miss my family. I feel like it's time to send me home. And I didn't see the entire video, but apparently she makes this sort of like, ha 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 plea to the bosses to allow her to go home, and then started crying.
Do you remember we did this case? It was Brooke Bennett in Vermont. And it was very similar to this. She was a preteen girl, and it was actually her uncle who had brought her into this horrificness. But it was this company of bosses. I think they said they were CIA or something like that. But it was always that threat of killing your family. We know what you're doing. We know where you're going. And we might sell you into sex slavery.
And how about also Colleen, the girl who was kept in a box under her captor's bed? He also, you know, said he was from the company and she had to sign a contract, and now he owned her and the company controlled everything.
And this was the hitchhiking one.
Correct.
Or one of the hitchhiking ones.
Yeah,
don't hitchhike.
California case. Exactly. Yeah. No hitchhiking.
70s.
Yes. But anyway, it's very easy to brainwash people and to...
Well, and especially preteen girls.
Well,
or even
I think anyone.
Well, I agree, especially if you're in a vulnerable position. But when you get 13, 14-year-olds, they don't know any better. Like, they're going to believe anything they're told.
Anything's possible because I am now here trapped in a dungeon.
Right.
And in a million years, I would have never believed this could happen to me.
Exactly.
And all the physical duress where every single moment you feel like you could die.
Right.
14-year-old Kirsten, she was in captivity for 2 years. When she got out, she did not tell her parents the truth. She said she had run away because Jamelski convinced her, understandably, her family would die, especially her brother. I know you have a brother, and I'm going to kill him if you tell anybody what happened. So she came home, and she said she had run away. Of course, they were happy to see her.
Right, because she'd already sent all those letters to them.
The truth didn't come out for quite some time. Yeah. And here's the weird part. This is how she was released. I find this so strange. At this point, she is supposedly his first victim, and he is saying, you know, he has bosses, they're very, you know, important and fancy and whatever else. So he goes to one of his sons and says, I need you to act as a chauffeur and pick me up and take me to the airport, and I'm going to have a friend with me. And so the son's like, okay. And he did. He acted as though he were a chauffeur. He took them to the airport, and Jamelski took Kirsten to Lake Tahoe. Was it Lake Tahoe?
It was Lake Tahoe.
Okay. They hung out. They went to casinos for like a week, I think it was. And then he gave her a one-way ticket back to Syracuse. And so she shows up after having this horrific experience, doesn't tell people the truth, and doesn't go to the police.
So the second victim was another 14-year-old. This one's name was Michelle, and she was taken in March of 1995, so this is 5 years after Kirsten was released. And she was also taken off South Geta Street. So they really just need to shut that street down.
Yeah, I feel like we need sawhorses on South Geta Street.
Exactly.
With no pedestrians, yeah, signs.
Or businesses or anything.
Right.
Just lock it down. Jamelski had stopped his car and engaged her in conversation and convinced Michelle that he wanted her to deliver a package for him. So she got into the car with Jamelski and they were on their way to deliver this package. But Michelle said the next thing she remembered was waking up in his dungeon and that she was naked and had chains on her ankle. She believed that she was given pills that knocked her out somehow, but she cussed at him, was trying to be as mean as possible, and of course it didn't do anything. She also was raped daily, and he took nude photos of her, and he told her that he sold young girls to other countries for the purpose of sex slavery. He then showed her photos of her family so that he could prove that he knew where to find them, and he threatened to kill her or her family members if she didn't agree to do what he told her to.
Can you imagine? I can't even imagine how terrifying that would be.
Every day of your life.
Like seeing the people you love in a photo and you're like, oh my God, this perverted jerk.
And every day you're there, you're worried that he's doing it anyway.
Oh, totally.
In 1997, so this is 2 years after she was taken captive, Jamelski decided to release her and dropped her off at her mother's house in Syracuse, where she had a very tearful reunion with her family. Now, she told her family what happened, and her parents really wanted to report it, but she convinced them not to because he had pictures of the family. He threatened to kill all of them, and that wasn't a chance she wanted them to take. So they didn't report it. Now, for several weeks after Michelle's return, her mom noticed that there was like an older, skinny white man who kept driving by their house from time to time. And so the mom went to Michelle and said, do we know who this guy is? And she said, that's the man who took me. And every time he went by, he was staring at Michelle.
I can't imagine feeling so unprotected.
Or as a parent, not being able to protect your child or children. It's that power of suggestion, the fear of the unknown that I think gets to you, because I remember when Elizabeth Smart was kidnapped in Utah and her sister, who was in the bedroom when Elizabeth was kidnapped, was told, don't say anything to your parents or I will kill them and Elizabeth. Because she, of course, she was little too. I think she was like 8 or 9 and didn't want to harm her family. And it's that permeation of that fear that they count on.
It's so easy to scare a young person.
Yeah, especially, I hate to say it, a young girl.
Yeah, it's easy, especially after you've been abused.
For 2 years.
Both of the 14-year-olds, so the first two victims, Kirsten and Michelle, never went to the police. The third victim did. And the third victim was Tina. And this was...
And she was not 14.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. She was 52 years old. And she was walking by herself in Syracuse. This is August of 1997.
And it didn't say specifically, but we know it was South Geta Street.
Exactly. Oh, my goodness.
But this is 2 years after Michelle was returned home.
Right. And so Tina was kidnapped. And I believe Tina did not speak English fluently. She was Vietnamese after she was released because it took 8 months for her to be released. She needed help communicating. And so I don't know if that's because she was traumatized or because she was English second language, to be honest with you.
Or it could be both.
Yeah. But anyway, so August of 1997, he convinces her to get into his car, and she does, and she is taken to his dungeon and receives the same treatment as the prior two victims. Her boyfriend reported her missing. It's difficult for police to believe that a 52-year-old woman is gone for any reason other than her own choice.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so 8 months after she is gone, she was released at a bus station. She was blindfolded. And after Jamelski drove away, she took off her blindfold. She went to the police, but it was reported that they didn't believe her.
And she was, remember now, the first of them to go to the police because the first two did not.
With respect to Tina, I could not find much in the newspapers. I think she was the most private about her experience. Extremely traumatized. I saw one interview by her. When I say I saw one. What I meant was I read one.
Right.
And it was a very brief, and she was tremendously scarred. And she said at one point she must have been fighting. She did something to resist him, and he slapped her so hard that she suffered hearing loss in one of her ears. She said one time he went away for 2 weeks and he only left her a half-eaten hot dog to eat. And so she was totally, totally scarred. When she went to police, and here's the thing, I'm not sure specifically where she's from. And so I don't know
which police station she went to.
Exactly, which department it was. But in the paper, she was quoted as saying that the police were screaming at her and calling her a liar.
It just kind of follows with what we've already said, right? So the first two victims did not report. The third one did and was screamed at and not believed. The fourth reported and was not really believed, and they kind of investigated. But it was the fifth victim, Jane, who brought everything to light.
Exactly. Once she gave them a man, an ID, a house, it was a downhill slide from there.
Wall of thugs.
Exactly. That search warrant sealed his coffin, so to speak.
Now we're back to 2003, after Jamelski has been arrested, after Jane was able to get in touch with her sister, and the police descended and took him away. He was charged on April 10th of 2003 with kidnapping, rape, and sodomy.
And this was the day after he was arrested from Jane. And so once the other victims were discovered and came forward, obviously charges attended to their victimization were added to the complaint.
The question is, John Jamelski, who is this stain on the fabric of society?
Wow. It's true. It is.
Jamelski had worked at grocery stores for years as a produce manager, and then he was also a handyman and worked odd jobs. But at the age of 68, now at the point where he was arrested, he was retired from this work, and it appeared that he was making a lot of money from returning bottles.
And yes, she is being facetious.
I am being facetious. So apparently, though, he was not only frugal, but he was kind of a miser with everything he did. Stingy,
totally.
All of that. We mentioned one son. He actually had three sons from whom he was estranged. They were all independent, successful men. He had a wife of 31 years who was a teacher, but she got cancer and actually passed away in 1999. So this is 11 years into when the first known victim had been kidnapped. And from everything we understand, she had no idea what was going on in the basement or what her husband was doing.
And another thing, like, so Kat talked about his frugality, and it was known. Like, the one son who actually gave a statement to the paper, and I only saw it one time. Well, I mean, it was repeated in every other paper, but I saw one actual
the same statement
quote, exactly.
One time.
Basically said he would fight over 5 cents. And so his local librarian, I read the story and I'm like, no way. He went to the library one day and he asked the librarian, could you do me a favor and clip the coupons for me? So this librarian starts doing the coupon collecting for him. And then she decides, you know what? This is for the birds. I'm not doing this anymore. So he comes in one day and I guess was very angry and started screaming at her for not
doing
clipping
a favor?
His coupons. Exactly. And so she's like, clip your own damn coupons. And she showed him like a pile of newspapers and he was too lazy to do it himself.
Of course he was.
Yeah.
So the frugality was strong.
Yeah. So he stormed out of the library.
Frugal, but lazy.
Yes. And stormed out of the library and, you know.
Never returned.
Never to return. He never spent money on anything. His property was a mess. And he just was an extraordinary penny pincher. Probably not a fun guy to go out with.
No, probably not.
Nope, not a guy.
Or be married to or have as a dad.
Not a guy who's going to buy you a beer.
Right. As police now are looking into John Jamelski to find out, you know, have they had any run-ins with him before? What is his background like? All of that. They discover that he had a proclivity for cruising. And I'm guessing South Geddes Street was one of the places he cruised all the time. But when they ran his car, this is the Mercury Comet, they discovered that his license plate number had been run through their computers dozens of times prior to 2002. And in fact, by 2003, the record showed, Kat, that his plate had been checked by various police units at least 70 times.
This is crazy. But it also plays in, like,
And these are different dates, by the way. This isn't 70 times in a night.
Exactly. And many different cities, if I understand correctly.
Yes, yeah, you're exactly right.
And we joked, or I joked earlier, about him going for girls on the wrong side of the tracks. But it's exactly what he did. And so my assumption when these inquiries were run, so if you're a police officer and you're out on patrol and you see something fishy, you run a plate. You want to see if there's wants or warrants.
Right.
All of these police officers on patrol who ran his plates, Kathy and I talked about this because it wasn't exactly explained. My assumption is that they knew he was cruising for women. He was probably in an area that was frequented by prostitutes and he had a very distinctive vehicle.
Right.
My guess is that they saw him many times. They click in his little license plate to see what's going on there. There's no warrants. There's no
wants. And if they weren't
wants.
Catching him picking someone up, they didn't have a reason without that to pull him over.
Exactly. It's just an inquiry. But it's crazy because, you know, he even admitted later that he loved cruising. He would drive around. He would spend hours and hours driving around. We now know, of course, he was looking for potential victims.
And it was like 8 or 9 different counties that this was run in.
Right.
So he clearly was spreading around so that he wasn't 70 times by Onondaga County.
Right. I don't know if was it counties or cities that they were talking to?
It was both.
Okay. But anyway, so yeah, the guy was busy doing his driving.
Being up to no good.
Correct.
So as we've been talking about this, we talked about all of his bad habits and proclivities and all that sort of stuff. And his frugality was not a good thing until you looked at his bank book, which at this point in his life, he was a millionaire. And it wasn't just the land he owned. With all of his penny pinchingness, and that is now a word, he was actually investing some of it and did very well in his investments, either by happenstance or by knowledge, but he still did very well with
right.
it. He also used it to buy some land in California, which typically does well as long as it's not 2008. And Kathy, you were telling the story about where he used to own a large plot of land in this area.
I want to say that his property at the time he was arrested was about an acre. And I believe he owned a larger piece of land he sold to developers, but he would not sell the house that he was living in. And he wouldn't sell that
acre around it.
Little tiny piece of land, much to the dismay of the developer, because what wound up happening is around his house, all of these McMansions started popping up.
And remember, this is a hoarder house.
Correct. And so the houses that the developer built around him, I want to say they were like $700,000 and above. These were beautiful pieces of property on beautiful pieces of land. And then there's his dank
eyesore.
Exactly. And so the developer built a 10-foot fence around his property.
As in 10-foot high.
Yes. So that his neighbors didn't have to look at it. In fact, when the police came to serve a search warrant, he had some kind of like fake human skull posted on top of his fence.
Of course he did.
You know, I mean, anyway, so there was no love lost between Jamelski and his neighbors.
Right.
I'm sure they were so happy when he was arrested. Oh, finally, somebody will buy that property.
Exactly.
He had advised his dad to invest in certain stocks or something that I believe he eventually wound up inheriting, and they did very well. So, yeah. You know, we've talked about Jamelski's character and
lack thereof.
Yes. And just like circumstances about him. But he actually blamed his proclivities to need a woman to have sex with on the fact that he could not have sex with his wife because she had cancer. So he got on Viagra, and I read one article that said he was on Viagra and he would mix it with an over-the-counter medication that intensified the effect. But I mean, the fact that he was blaming his wife's cancer, I'm sure there are many deeper layers to this man, like sociopathy might be one
of them.
I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
What happened is he was charged, as we said, with rape, sodomy, and kidnapping. He actually wound up pleading guilty to these charges. And on July 14th of 2003, so not that much longer after...
Like 3 months?
Yeah.
After Jane was able to get him arrested?
Exactly. He did plead guilty in Onondaga County and then was there to face sentencing. Now, this is a packed courtroom, and as part of the plea deal, which was in addition to actually the time he was going to spend in prison, they actually arrived at an agreement where he would sell everything, liquidate everything, so the land and the stocks and everything else, and the proceeds would be split between the five survivors who had come forward. Now, I've never seen a dollar amount attached to that, and it's been 20 years.
I did read somewhere, I didn't read about how the money was actually divided specifically. I did, however, read the money was divided according to your length of imprisonment with him.
Wow, that's fair.
Yeah, no, I agree. Totally fair. And that's like a kind of a unique thing to do. The judge was extremely instrumental in Jamelski liquidating his assets.
That's awesome. So here's the interesting thing about a sentencing hearing. So he was actually sentenced to 18 years to life. So 18 has to be the minimum sentence that he serves. And he was hoping the judge wouldn't give him 18 years. He was really thinking he was going to get off easy, maybe a couple years in prison, something like that. And when the judge actually sentenced him to 18 years, he was overcome with emotion. He started saying to the judge, "Why are you doing this to me? I was good to them. They got to lay around and watch TV all day. They didn't have any responsibilities. Like, I was nice to them. We were buddies. I was a good person to them." And he sounded like he believed it.
And see, that's the thing. Like, after he was sentenced, he gave an interview in the jailhouse to the Post Standard of Syracuse, which, by the way, was the newspaper that I thought did the best reporting on this. Everybody was quoting the Post Standard. It was kind of impressive. Like, those journalists were relentless. In this interview, when they were like, "What? Dude." And he said, "They were my buddies. I was helping them out. Like, some of these girls actually had a better life with me."
Right. "I didn't hurt them. We had a business agreement."
That's what he was saying.
"They were there voluntarily."
He kept saying there was no violence.
Right.
He denied hitting Tina and making her, you know, hurting her.
Lose hearing.
He called them his buddies. He called them his friends. He said that he had business, like a business agreement, like you said.
Yeah.
"Like, you live with me, you have sex with me, I'll pay you some money.
And I'll give you the finest accommodations in the house."
Exactly. And they had to be locked up because he wanted to ensure that he had disease-free sex.
Yeah.
So, like, what we call a dungeon, he called a party room.
"I don't want to go to that party."
Yeah, exactly. "Keep me out of that party." And so he was totally delusional, and it did appear that he believed what he was saying. And his attorney basically was like, "This isn't going to fly." He goes to prison, and when he is 86 years old, and this is in 2020, it was his first parole hearing. He had served 18 years by that point, and he had the nerve to talk to the parole board in the same tone that he had used when he was interviewed shortly after his conviction in the jailhouse. He talked about they had scented candles.
Bubble baths.
They had bubble baths. They were homeless. I was providing a place that was better. I was encouraging them to go to school.
Right.
I wanted to read this thing. Like, I found some of the parole documents, like they had a transcript, and I didn't read the entire thing. The parole board asked him, "How did you meet these people?" And he said, "I had a bunker and people knew I had a bunker. We partied a lot out there, and I was approached every now and then by someone that said it would be a good idea if a friend of hers who was a runaway, rather than be on the streets, that they came here. You know, it was a trade-off. We had sex. I would encourage them to go back to their families as soon as they could. And only time in the bunker was used for just a few parties and stuff. And then someone else would come in, and then a third, and then a fourth. And obviously there was a fifth one, but in between there was nobody else, nobody else." And then it was like, "Mr. Jamelski, again, how did you meet these women?" And he's like, "Partying in the street." Like, the man had an altered way of looking at things. And of course, parole was denied. And then again, he was up for parole in 2023 when he was 88 years old-ish. And then that was denied as well.
Thankfully.
Yes. The victims actually said it the best. And I'm just going to read a couple quotes from these women and girls who recounted some of their horror. This is victim number 3. That would be Kirsten. "I am haunted every moment, even in sleep, by the thought of my months with Mr. Jamelski. The cold, dampness, darkness, and loneliness. I will never forget the constant hunger, thirst, and fatigue. I thought of death, and would it be better than life than what I was being put through? And then Jennifer said, "It was horrifying what this old man has done to me and these other women. I have lived in fear ever since. I am afraid of the dark, of basements, and of old men. I have horrible dreams at night, and I cry out in my sleep." Jane, the one who ended all of it,
right,
said, "You will never be able to know the fear I felt being raped every day, sometimes three times a day. The nightmares I had, making disgusting videos, being humiliated, never having any privacy or having the use of a toilet or a shower, or being chained like a dog to a fence. I hope in time I will be able to forgive the horrifying things you force me to do day after day." Then she concludes by saying, "You are the sickest man I've ever known. Every time you came to that door, I wanted to kill you." One thing is certain, all of these women suffered incredibly and exhibited true resilience and did what they needed to do to survive.
Thanks for listening.
See you next time.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.